Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. We all know people listen to radio and watch television. The difference then between radio and television is the image. When you listen to radio, your mind creates the image for you. When you watch television, a ready-made image is flashed before your eyes. The early days of television were times of great creativity when the questions of how and what should we do were presented at all levels of production, ownership, and programming. In the early 1950s, a young professor from Stanford University named Stanley Donner was creatively engaged in the development of public television in San Francisco, California. In the succeeding 50 years, Professor Donner participated in and followed the development of this vast medium. I met with Professor Stanley Donner in the studios of Radio Curious in September of 1998 to talk about television.
The Federal Communications Committee was made up of all commercial people, people interested in commercial television, except one. And this was a woman of name of Frieda Hennock, and she was an attorney, and a very bright, strong, powerful woman, and no fooling with Frieda Hennock at all, because she was called the Jeanne d'Arc of educational television. She was certainly that. If it hadn't been for her, I don't think we ever would have gotten on the air except in a few spots in the United States. But she was ever after it and ever getting things done for educators to use television. And since I was in charge of the television at Stanford, then I went to conventions and the like. And there was an annual one held in Columbus, Ohio, and I went one year, and I think the year probably was 1949 or 50, one of the two, I think. But there was no educational television in San Francisco, and Frieda Hennock was one of the people at this convention, and the three or four of us stayed up till 2 a.m. just talking with this woman, because she's so brilliant and so strong and so interested and such a passionate woman in terms of education in the United States. It was just a remarkable person. And we young people were interested in talking to her, and just to have somebody that was so excited about the medium as we were. And she turned to me about 2:15 in the morning and said, "Where are you from?" And I said, "I'm from Stanford." "Oh," she said, "you're from Stanford. Oh, I'll tell you what you've got to do tomorrow morning. Tomorrow morning without fail." I said, "What am I to do without fail tomorrow morning?" And I began to get scared right away. She said, you've got to make application in the name of Stanford University for Channel 9 in San Francisco. Channel 9 in San Francisco. The commercial people are trying to get Channel 9, and they will get it in a matter of days if you don't act. You've got to do this." Well, I said, "I'm sorry, I'd like to help you out, but I can't do that because Stanford is a private university and we cannot do public things like this. We have our own public, our own small public that we serve at the university, but we're not a general institution like the University of California at Berkeley, which is, that's the place you should go." She said, "No, they're not doing anything, and you are. You've got to be the one." I thought I'd lose my job. You won't lose your job. Do it. Do you hear me? Do it. Well, I had a sleepless night. I thought, oh my goodness, if I try to do this, I mean, I might, could lose my job. I didn't think I would because I was a very good friend of Wally Sterling, who was president. We were good friends. But I sent the message off to the committee and asked that that Channel 9 be reserved for Stanford University for educational television. And I got back to Stanford and went in the president's office and I said, I've done a terrible thing. I told him what I'd done. He said, oh, look, Stan, you know better. You know better. You can't do this. I said, no, but what we will do, we'll just buy time. If we have a month or something, we can probably set some kind of a group of people who will support this and be the real owners or real directors of Channel 9. Since we can't do it, and Cal is supposedly not that interested at this point. So that's what we want to do. And he said, well, you better work fast because this is trouble for us. I said, I understand. And I did start right that very morning. I went to Cal and talked to the people there. And of course, as I thought, they were not interested. But they would be a member of a committee. So I went around and I got probably 20 or 30 outfits, if you can call them outfits, schools and universities and colleges all in the Bay Area. And we formed there a Bay Area Television Association. And for a long time, I don't know what it's now, but for a long time, the Bay Area Television Association were the owners, so to speak, of Channel 9. And they were the early people, the first people to really take power in their own hands. And I think it's still existing, but I'm not au courant at all.
So what happened once you got the Bay Area...
Say again?
What happened once you got the Bay Area Television Association together? How did you get Channel 9 to be a public entity?
Well, the first thing they did was to try to get a good person, if they could, as a manager of the station. And they got Jim Day. And Jim Day was a marvelous person for that job. And he became well-known, especially on the East Coast, for his work in educational television throughout the nation. And he came and gave a lecture here a year ago, I think. And I went down to hear him and to talk with him myself. We hadn't seen each other in 20 or 30 years. It was very nice. But that's what they did first. And he got the program manager, and then gradually we got somebody to run a camera and had somebody on the switchboard. So bit by bit, the thing began to become a station. And we had an old garage on Fifth Street in San Francisco, and that we put up egg crates all around in what we thought was our studio. And it was kind of primitive, but boy, I think the programs they were doing were quite remarkable.
Can you remember some of those programs?
Well, Jim Day himself had a program that I thought was one of the best that I had heard then or now. He turned out to be just a wonderful guy at doing the kind of thing that you're doing now. He was interviewing people. But he found a man who was a longshoreman, and he would be the least likely person you would think to have on educational television. But he was an extraordinarily well-read person, and Jim Day just talked with him, just like you and I are talking now.
Was that person Eric Hoffer?
Yes, you know him. Oh, you know him too.
Yes, he was someone who I interviewed a long time ago.
Yes.
I remember going to his house because I wanted to talk to him.
To Hoffer. Yeah, you went yourself.
I called him up and said, can I come over and interview you? And he said, sure, when do you want to do it? And I said, tomorrow. And he said, 5 o'clock, and told me where he lived.
Oh, that's wonderful. You're one of the few people I've run across and that have even known about that. But when I saw Jim Day a few months back, I reminded him of the Hoffer series. And he laughed and said, yeah, he enjoyed it. But he had the great talent that I think you also have of listening to the person being interviewed because that's hard to do. It's hard to do that. Each person would like to take control himself and talk himself, and you're very quiet. You just ask questions, and that's the way Jim Day did. And he was the first one that I knew that did that kind of interviewing. And it's, among the great interviewers, it's done. That's considered to be the way to do it. But at the beginning, it was not that way, except by Jim Day. Everybody else was trying to get their own voice on the air, and they didn't care about the person they were interviewing.
That's very kind of you. Stan, I'm interested in the theory of communication. You were a communications professor for many years.
Yes.
What were some of the different issues that you brought out and shared with your students?
Well, my first thing with teaching anything about communication at Stanford or at the University of Texas in Austin was to start with the theory of communication. And the theory of communication consists roughly of two parts. One part is just how to do it. How do you do it? How do you communicate? And the other part of it is what are the disasters? What are the damages? What are the things that go wrong? Or what are the things that are not really, they're anti-communications? The kinds of things that...
Talk to us about some of those.
Beg your pardon?
Tell us about some of those.
Oh, anti-communication? I think our late president was a master at that, of putting out information that was not...
Ronald Reagan?
Sir?
Ronald Reagan?
No. His
Nixon.
Who?
Nixon. This is a guessing game. It sounds like you're talking about Richard Nixon?
Yes, Richard Nixon. And he was a master at what I would call non-communication, or it could be called interference in communication. There's probably that's what a engineer would say. We're getting interference now. But there's a way of communicating in which you're not really communicating. You're trying to do exactly the opposite. You're trying not to communicate. And so there are people, and I think President Nixon was one of them, who could do this with great skill.
I'd like to take a moment and say that my guest this week is Professor Stanley Donner. We're talking about the history of public television in California, and at the moment, about President Richard Nixon's skill at not communicating. You're listening to Radio Curious on World Radio. I'm Barry Vogel.
Dan, could you give us an example of what you mean by that?
When President Nixon was rapidly moving toward disaster himself because of things that he had done, I think some of them unwittingly perhaps, but he was then trying to cover his tracks, so to speak, and he did that in many times by this non-communication. Of course, you mentioned President Reagan. He did some of that by appearing not to remember. As he said often, "Well, I just don't remember that," he would say. And he's quite persuasive as a communicator himself, quite good. But he would use the communication then as a non-communication. He just simply said, "I don't remember." Well, if you don't remember, then you can't report on it. So that was a pretty good way to do it if you're going to want to be a non-communicator. So there are skills of that kind, anti-skills, if you wanted to call them that, that have to do with not communicating. We were not trying to teach our students not to communicate. We were trying to teach them to communicate. But they had also to see what non-communication was. And then there were about 12 or 13 ways in which communication can go wrong. Where we were, for example, not right now, we're on the air, so the mechanical and electronic things have to operate in order for us to do this. And it's quite remarkable, as we all know, that we can do this. But it's also one of the difficulties, because things can go wrong. You can lose your power. Well, power is the most important thing in trying to broadcast, because you have all other kinds of things that are anti-communication things, or things that cause disaster in communication. I think we had one man at Stanford who this was his field almost of anti-communication, and he had 11 steps or 11 methods or 11 things that normally happen. And I attended his lecture and copied down the 11. I thought they were so wonderful. And I used his 11 things, giving him credit for lectures later on, because I thought he had narrowed the thing and gotten it so one could handle it.
Can you tell us what some of those 11 are?
Oh, well. Well, a simple one would be what was happening to us before we went on the air. We were having some problems with getting our volume of your voice and my voice to be balanced. And that's a mechanical one, but that's one. The mechanical thing has got to be operative. That's one. Then the intention of the communicator is the other. That's when we were talking about President Nixon and President Reagan. What was their intention? What were they trying to communicate? Were they trying to communicate or not? They were not communicating. Was that due to something as extraneous, something that they didn't even know they were doing, or something that was happening to them at the time, or something they didn't wish to communicate for maybe national or international reasons? It could be that.
I find on that level, listening to politicians, they'll often give out information with total disregard of what the question is.
Yes, that's true. That's true. That would be another wonderful example of the same thing that I'm trying to talk about, yes. And the people get skillful at this, where you ask them one thing and they don't answer that, they answer another.
I remember talking with William Rehnquist. William Rehnquist, he's now the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
Oh, yes, I did.
And this was in at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island,
yes,
in the spring of 1971, when Nixon was in a great deal of trouble himself, yes, and college campuses were asking a lot of questions about Nixon and about the Vietnam War. So at that time, William Rehnquist was the assistant United States Attorney General, and he came to Brown University, and I just happened to be on campus that day, and he was talking, supposed to talk about what was going on in Southeast Asia, but instead he was just talking about literature and flowers and books, and when people would try to pin him down and press him on questions, he'd make 100% eye contact, shake their hand, and talk about literature and flowers and how nice it is to be at Brown and Providence. But he never once asked the question, even when we challenged him on the fact that the question was this, and he was answering in a total disregard.
Yes.
In the most sincere persona.
Yes. Well, this would be considered to be a communication failure.
Intentional failure.
But I remember at the University of Texas, I got down on my knees. I won a lecture, big classes there, about 500 students. I got down on my knees and talked with Phoebe, who was in one of the books where she worried about the ducks in Central Park when it came winter and the pond froze, what happened to the ducks. And so Phoebe and I talked about this, but what I was trying to illustrate to the students is that age has a lot to do with this too. She was, I think Phoebe was 6, and she was a bright 6-year-old, all right, but she wasn't the mature 6-year-old, so, I mean the mature woman yet. So I was trying to illustrate just that kind of communication. It's very important with children as your teacher. How do you communicate? How do you get the people really to respond? Because that's very hard to do, really, as a teacher. Because many times in high school, for example, the students are actually trying not to learn. They've got all their barriers up. And some way you've got to get them to take those down so you can have a communication flow. They can talk back to you, you can talk to them. And they have a response like that. But that's difficult.
Well, how do you take those barriers down? How do you develop that communication flow?
Well, you have to know in the first place that they're there. And then you've got to learn about why they're there. Who is profiting by this event? If it's the kids at school and high school level, it probably be that they are not themselves, they're shutting themselves off. So that's in itself a small disaster, I think. But also, it's making the teacher impossible to teach. She can't do what she's there to do. And so you reach a deadlock. And that's a very hard thing. And you see it happen also in the Congress of the United States. They're doing this kind of thing. This kind of thing is happening, probably purposefully. It's not an inadvertent thing there at all. It's well planned in advance. Well, for example, a filibuster is a way of occupying the airtime, so to speak, in Congress, so another congressman can't use it. So he'll filibuster, sometimes 24 hours, 48 hours, or go on 72 hours.
As long as they can continue talking, they have the floor.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Well, Stan, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, and before I ask you the question about the book that you know I'm going to ask, I'd like to ask you about the future of communications. The future of electronic communications. You've been involved in the history of them and the hands-on development of them. What do you speculate will be the future?
I think I ought to tell you about my last lecture at the University of Texas in Austin, which had happened in 1976. And my last lecture was on computers. And of course, IBM had the big computer out by then. And their original one filled a whole room like this studio with nothing but equipment just for one computer. And so I was telling the students that I thought that this computer business was not going to succeed in the United States, that it was a sudden flare-up and we would not hear of it at all in 2 or 3 years. Of course, it spread throughout the whole of the United States and every family and every business, everywhere, the computer.
But I'm sure you have some ideas about where the future of electronic communication, radio and television and telephones, where they will take us.
Oh, that'd just be sure conjecture. I don't really know. And I don't know. I just have to say I don't know. Having made the great gaffe on computers, I feel a little inadequate because I was telling everybody it was the end of it right then. And that was 1976.
Well, Stanley Donner, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I would like to ask you to tell us about an interesting book.
Yes, well, there's a book that I'm having vision problems, so I get people to read to me, and this book is being read to me, and it's called The Fox and the Fox and the Hedgehog. And the fox and the hedgehog really comes from Greek times, or somewhere in that distance, because the fox has thousands of options. He's quick, he's fast, he knows where to head, he knows what to do. He's one of the remarkable animals of all time. And the hedgehog, au contraire, is... he's got only one thing, and he knows how to get back in the hedge and hide. And I'd never even seen one of those until a year ago, and I almost stepped on a hedgehog in a really wet, rainy night, and my son Marco pulled me back so I didn't step on him. But they're so different in their way they approach things and their abilities. So that's what this book is about. It's the hedgehog or the fox. And the question has to do with Dostoevsky, the writer. And is he a hedgehog or is he a hedgehog? Is he a hedgehog or a fox? And that's what the book is about.
And what's the answer?
Well, my answer to it is he's a fox. But I haven't read all of Dostoevsky, and I haven't read all of his book to see what Isaiah Berlin says. But it's an interesting approach to stuff like this, I think.
Well, Stanley, I understand that you're leaving on a trip for France tomorrow.
Yes.
And we wish you well and hope that we can visit again when you return.
Well, thank you. I look forward to it myself. I've enjoyed our meeting together a lot. Thank you for having me.
Professor Stanley Donner was one of the organizers of public television in San Francisco, California, in the early 1950s. The book he recommends is The Hedgehog and the Fox, an essay on Tolstoy's view of history by Sir Isaiah Berlin. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.